Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
I'm Alva.
I'm Anoush.
And I'm Stephen.
And you're listening to the New Statesman podcast. On today's episode, we discuss the budget, and you ask us, has Nicola Sturgeon done enough to save her career? So Rishi Sunak delivered the much anticipated budget yesterday, setting out his plans for the last bit of the coronavirus crisis, he hopes, extending things like furlough for a bit, but then basically announcing an end to the universal credit uplift, an eventual end to the furlough scheme, and eventually tax increases and cuts. Did we all enjoy Budget Day? Stephen, should I start with you? What do you think are the key takeaways from this?
The key takeaways are twofold. Firstly, austerity is back, both in rhetoric and in fact. Actually, there's a really interesting debate here, I think, which is that if you look at the detail, not of what he said, but the detail of what's actually in the budget, right? This is an incredibly austere budget because it has a large number of tax rises because the freezes in the various thresholds on income tax expenditures are all tax rises, right? Freezes in thresholds. Actually, interestingly, the corporation tax rise, where I'm just like, is that really going to happen? I doubt it somehow. It just feels like something they can have, which will make all of their fiscal forecasts look a bit better. The corporation tax rise will have the same role as these cuts will be grandfathered into universal credit did under George Osborne, with then about £4 billion of extra cuts on top of what was already baked in to the previous end of austerity. Sorry, I don't know why I persist in doing air quotes with my hands in an audio medium. But I do. I just did air quotes there on the end of austerity. Now, there are two ways to look at that $4 billion. One is to essentially do what a variety of really interesting people, Jonathan Hopkin, really worthwhile economist following if you're on Twitter, the head of the IFS, Paul Johnson, both basically looking at that number and going, if you think that, or as Paul Johnson said, he was just like, I would not give you odds of 1 to 10 that incredibly painful program of cuts to unprotected departments is going to happen. So there's basically the kind of austerity is back in rhetoric people who think you can't do that and they will exist in budget documents, but they won't actually happen, broadly defined. And then there's the kind of other people who go, yeah, that's a big number and it will happen, or it will happen a bit in addition to the already baked in cuts in austerity, particularly to local government and social care, which Anoush wrote a very good piece on. So I think, the first thing is austerity with a combination of tax rises and spending cuts is back. I haven't sat down and done the maths, which I really should have, sorry. So in the last phase of austerity was something like 70-30 cuts to rises. I suspect this is probably more 60-40 rises to cuts, but it's obviously still a very austere budget on the back of 10 years of spending restraint. So that's kind of one interesting thing, is basically whether or not, A, whether the electorate or the public realm can withstand that, two, whether the rhetoric of it will continue to be popular, right? One conservative said to me a long time before this budget was even thought of, and they said, the most successful place for the Conservative Party to be on fiscal matters is for a bunch of cuts to be announced but not to happen. And they said, so really, I guess what we ought to do is just announce a bunch of equally impractical reforms we failed to deliver on as we did with universal credit. And we can just continue, the cuts. When new schools come in, they will be cut. I think that argument has some merit to it politically. The second thing is that Rishi Sunak clearly believes that the British economy doesn't require all that much stimulus. There's the super deduction, which will encourage people to move investment forward. But I think also one should, if you look at the stimulus measures in this budget, ask yourself about, obviously there are two economic challenges that this budget's having to respond to: the loss of our close trading relationship with the European Union and the coronavirus recession. Then broadly, all of the stimulus measures in it look more like they are designed around the EU membership, the fact that, I was about to say this is an article of faith, not necessarily true, but it's definitely something that Rishi Sunak believes, is that we will have more onshoring of, so things like vaccines will be, and PPE will become onshored in pretty much all countries. That's not really a sort of traditional stimulus measure, and so, the kind of the plant and machinery, a super tax deduction. This is a budget by someone who doesn't think that the economy is going to need all that much of a push to recover from the coronavirus, and that the economy will be strong enough to absorb two things. One, as Alva, you say, is the cut in universal credit in 6 months' time. Now, universal credit is, of course, its most important function, which arguably something doesn't do very well because of the extent to which benefits have fallen as a share of incomes over the last decade, is that it provides a safety net for people who really need it. But its important macroeconomic function is it provides a stabilizer to the economy in bad times. And the big thing you are betting on, if there's a chance that you cut 20 quid, is A, that you can survive politically the cost of the hardship you're causing, but also that the economy itself is not going to need that £20. That aggregate £20. And also, the other kind of bet he's made is the minimum wage increase is the smallest since 2013, but it is still a floor in the statutory wage floor at a time when a large number, maybe not most, but definitely not all, but a large number of low wage sectors are particularly heavily affected by the economic effects of lockdown. Now, I think actually Rishi Sunak is probably right about the fact that the economy doesn't need all that much help coming out of the coronavirus recession. I think he should have done more about private and household debt that's been accrued during the pandemic. But that's a slightly different set of policy interventions. But I think those are the interesting things. Austerity is back, whether in fact or in rhetoric. And Rishi Sunak believes that the economy is not going to need all that much of a push to get out of the coronavirus recession.
On that first point about austerity, Anoush, you wrote about this yesterday. Do you think that, as Stephen was saying, this is a pretty austere budget? Do you feel like that kind of hasn't been reflected sufficiently in the coverage of it? Especially because, it's been a recurring theme on this podcast for, the best part of a year, if not longer, that the Conservatives at the last election were kind of implicitly standing on, an end of austerity platform. And we've talked before about how austerity and the end of it are themselves kind of almost meaningless phrases, because people will just, interpret those in different ways. That at the last election, some of the most overt austere rhetoric had ended, but a lot of cuts were still baked in. But now we're kind of properly back to it. And you took us through some of the details of that in your piece yesterday. So do you think that it hasn't been reflected sufficiently, that this is actually a much more austere return to cuts and so on than you would get from some of the coverage?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's right, because not least because Boris Johnson explicitly said towards the beginning of the crisis that austerity wouldn't be part of the recovery. And every chancellor, I think, since Philip Hammond, I think, has been saying that the end of austerity is in sight, or implicitly saying it. So we should take that as a marker and judge, what the budget looks like compared with that, at least that tonal change. And I do think it hasn't really been appreciated, even with this budget, where it's very obvious, what the future sort of course of the recovery is going to look like in terms of tax rises and cuts. I don't think it has fully been appreciated. I was looking at the front pages this morning, and there's very much a kind of spend now, tax later line. And some of these figures that he's spending on the rest of the coronavirus recovery are in their billions. And, it all sounds very generous and like high numbers, and also tax rises, particularly on firms, sounds like, you're trying to get the most for your recovery out of the rich rather than off the backs of the poor, which I think covers up in a way, in terms of coverage, how far-reaching some of these cuts are going to be. What's interesting is that, you know, there was £12 billion worth of cuts to departmental spending announced in the spending review last year. And yet still, I do think that the kind of, because I think lots of our coverage, particularly in our print media, are focused around sort of right-wing attacks on the government, the whole kind of vibe of Rishi Sunak has been like, oh, he's being forced to be really generous and spend loads of money like a Labour chancellor, when actually, you know, he'd much rather get back to a more austere agenda. But that sort of suggests that he hasn't been announcing cuts, and he has the whole time. And there are more in this budget to come. Labour are going quite hard on the idea that there's £30 billion of cuts to the Department of Health, so on NHS funding. The government would argue that that's because of the fall in money that's going to be spent on the coronavirus response, because obviously they've had to ramp up spending so much during the pandemic. But the argument against that is that there is such a huge backlog for the NHS now, you know, all of the people that it didn't manage to treat during the pandemic. And sort of like all of these pressures building up that they are going to have to work through after this second wave is over, as they had to do briefly after the first wave in the summer, which one person who runs a hospital who I've spoken to sort of throughout this crisis told me was actually harder for some of the medics than the pandemic phase. So I think this symbolizes the fact that there's that particular cut symbolizes what I think is the most interesting thing about this budget, which shows the lack of ambition to change Britain and its economy after the pandemic passes. Labour's whole argument is that we should recover in a sort of new way, and obviously the government has this rhetoric of build back better, but there's no sign of building back better in this budget. Stephen mentioned, you know, the measures that Rishi Sunak wants to bring in to replace or to try and rebuild from what we've lost from leaving the EU. And of course, those things are going to make the economy look different. But there's no real ambition to try and solve the inequality in this country that has been so exposed by the pandemic, as well as the sort of public services that have been run ragged for so long. So it is a bit strange that there isn't that vision there. Maybe it's too early to have a vision like that, but obviously, every single thing that he announced in this budget is going to have long-term effects. So it looks like they want to go back to business as usual afterwards. And as we know from many of the areas that have suffered during the pandemic, particularly social care, which wasn't even mentioned in the budget, which we've been waiting for a plan for so long, we know that those areas have suffered, and there doesn't seem to be any plan in place to trying to make tomorrow's world better than the kind of society that we were living in when we went into this crisis.
I mean, I can't believe that you don't think moving a Treasury campus to Darlington will level us up anoosh. And 8 free ports.
The free ports thing is fascinating to me, because so I know this is a little bit like that old Jewish joke about, you know, this restaurant is terrible in such small portions. But the theory of a free port is you move economic activity to within an area, right? If you have 8 free ports in a country of our size, are you really going to get that benefit? It doesn't seem likely. But actually, the kind of the geography point and your point, Anish, about like not building back better, I think speaks to the other really interesting thing to me about this budget, which is there was very little, i.e. nothing at all, to prevent. Let's imagine that I'm the CFO at the New Statesman, right? And I've decided
that you're going to give me a pay rise.
I've decided that I'm going to cut your office space. But I've decided that, you know, it's not necessary for us to have our nice building in the Strand. We obviously need to retain the parliamentary desk. But that brick and mortar building, yeah, we're going to leave our lease. We're going to get rid of that building. And we will have a very small amount of office estate for entertainment and, you know, maybe onboarding and inductions. And that story is playing itself out throughout the economy, right? Lots of places are deciding to do that. I would strongly emphasize that I'm not becoming our CFO, and that is a pure hypothetical. Now, if you are, and I think the right has ended up in this fascinatingly incoherent position on this, right? In you pick up any right-wing newspaper or you follow any right-wing commentator on Twitter, and they're continually going, you know, office workers need to understand the economy works on people coming in and agglomeration, and it's just like,
guys, if you have a problem with this, your problem is what bosses are going to do. Realistically, I would love to live in a country with strong enough trade union and labour market rights than the factor on whether or not the office returns are going to be the aggregate preferences of workers. But I don't live in that country. I live in the United Kingdom in 2021. And unless there's something in this budget to change, you know, Stephen Bush, CFO's calculation of the risks and benefits. Now, in reality, one of the reasons why, of course, media organisations are bad examples, and I suspect one of the reasons why media coverage of this in general has been quite bad, is creative industries have a much more obvious direct benefit from the in-person stuff. But unless you're doing something as a, you know, as a business to say, yeah, so as a government to say, no, we are going to actively prevent, yeah, we're going to actively disincentivize you from realizing the supposed savings of paring back your office space, then the next couple of years are going to be quite painful, quite economically disruptive anyway. And the slight weird thing is that, which I mean, it's not really that surprising, but the other weird thing about this budget is very much a kind of, we'll press this button, people will go back into offices, and the only thing that will stop them going back into offices is something we can fix by exhorting workers to get back on their trains and get back in their cars and commute into their town and city centres. When the reality is, yeah, that ain't the problem as far as the end of office working is concerned.
And you've written your column this week, Stephen, about the sort of the new contours of the political debate to come, which I think we did see quite a lot of yesterday. We saw the shape of the case that Rishi Sunak wants to make, so sort of financial responsibility with that sort of sprinkling of levelling up and green investment on top, versus Keir Starmer saying that after a decade of conservative rule, we didn't go into the coronavirus pandemic with much economic resilience, and that the Conservatives don't really have a serious or ambitious plan to address any of the vulnerabilities that were exposed by the crisis. But I think a thing that's quite interesting is whether that will work for Rishi Sunak, because as we were just saying, the Conservatives in 2019 did stand on a manifesto that was, you know, about the end of austerity, about investment, about levelling up. Boris Johnson, you know, famously loves building bridges and tunnels. And I just wonder, you can see the case that Rishi Sunak is making, that it's worth leaning in to this public perception that the Conservatives are better at managing the finances than Labour. You can see the case that he's trying to make while also conceding to Boris Johnson's desire to, you know, do big infrastructure projects and to deliver on their 2019 commitments. But you just wonder, like, that's quite a small tightrope to walk. What do both of you think about, like, whether that's going to unravel in the years to come, or whether the shape of that conservative electoral message can actually be sustained for the next few years?
Yeah, I think at times Boris Johnson has won the argument in terms of keeping restrictions in place, but at times Rishi Sunak has won the argument, and I think this budget was an example of him winning the argument, because all of the supposed levelling up policies that were announced in the budget, and, you know, those that they've announced previously as well, just don't do what the sort of Boris Johnson style vision of focusing on infrastructure and rebalancing the regions in terms of their infrastructure and local economies are concerned. I just don't think they do what he would like them to do in his vision. Mainly because there's not enough actual power being devolved to the towns and the regions that are receiving some of the funding. And also because there is such an imbalance in where the funding is being focused. So I think what's going to come under a great deal of scrutiny now is the Levelling Up Fund, which is quite similar to the Towns Fund, which has had a lot of scrutiny for the places where the money is being directed to, being, you know, Tory marginals or in constituencies that are represented by Tory MPs, particularly those who won in 2019. There's been quite a lot of coverage of the Levelling Up funding going to regions that include Rishi Sunak's seat and Robert Jenrick's seat as well, which come lower in the deprivation index than other areas that have been given lower priority. So, I mean, that's a sort of political argument, but it also shows that perhaps this levelling up agenda is more to do with winning votes and being able to say the right things at the right time in the electoral cycle than actually levelling up. And I think that the main bit of evidence that shows that this isn't actually going to happen and that there will be that divide between the two ministers' visions is that councils just don't have any money. You know, there are a bunch of councils in February that had to get emergency bailouts from the government. It didn't get very much coverage, but it really should have done, because if your town hall can't deliver services to its residents, then how on earth are you supposed to be levelling up the country? It doesn't make sense to me. I know local government isn't sexy, and that any announcements on the issue are not going to be as exciting as coming up with some new high street fund or town regeneration project. But really, you do need to get those foundations in place. And the Public Accounts Committee have predicted that more councils are going to go bankrupt. So until they sort that out, I just don't believe them, because they don't have the foundations there to make these local places that they're obsessed with saying that they want to improve. They're just going to have no hope of doing that unless they actually focus on the fundamentals.
I think it's a really interesting and good question. I always feel guilty about giving this answer because I know it's a slightly grim thing to say about a real thing. But this is the thing that to me is actually really interesting, is that what we don't know is to what extent was the 2017 election and the whole run-up to it, and by the whole run-up to it, I mean the election of Corbyn, Brexit happening, it's okay. To what extent was all of that then basically, yeah, the government had reached the frontiers of what it could do in terms of cuts without bits of its coalition popping off, things it didn't want to happen happening, the Labour Party, yeah, having a huge revolution in how it organised itself. Right, to what extent are all of those things consequences of the same thing that lead to the Conservative Party losing its majority in 2017? And to what extent are they causes, right? In the one view is that you just would reach the end as a country of where you could do cuts without people visibly noticing. And then the first symptom of that was the Labour Party rank and file decision to back Jeremy Corbyn. The second consequence was the defeat of tax credit cuts in the Lords and by rebel Conservative backbenchers. The next was, obviously, the vast majority of the voters voted Brexit because they wanted to leave the EU. But obviously, you don't need to move that many votes for David Cameron to still be Prime Minister today. All of that stuff follows from austerity just becoming undeliverable. And then, bam, that reality hits the wall of the electorate in 2017. You know, despite lots of spinning about how Theresa May was, you know, moving to the left, you know, still sort of austerity in fact and in rhetoric from Philip Hammond, right? That's kind of theory one. And you would then go, well, what happened in 2019 was then by increasing spending on schools, police and hospitals, they were able a bit to kind of do that austerity is over. And then there's an open question about whether or not any of that spending matters, right? If you are spending more money on police, less money on social work, local authorities, do you just end up in a situation where there's more police but people feel more unsafe anyway for other reasons, right? Do you have more money going to the NHS but less money going to everyone else? Do you just end up with endemic bed blocking, crisis in social care? You know, all of that kind of stuff. And that would basically lead you to go, yeah, you can do what Philip Hammond and Sajid Javid did pre-2019, and that allows you to grit out an election in very limited and situation-specific circumstances. But if you keep pressing the button marked austerity, then one day you just wake up and your electoral coalition has fallen apart, as indeed has much of the public realm. That's kind of theory one. Theory two is the problem in 2017 was Philip Hammond did not have, I would like to say, a prominent role. I mean, had no role in the general election campaign. There was no economic argument made by the Conservatives. They made no attempt to rebut Labour's arguments. Yeah, Labour faced no direct attack from the Tories on economic credibility because the Conservatives had no economic message. And then what happened in 2017 is what happens when you quit the pitch. Now, the confounder is that, of course, everything that the Tories did under Boris Johnson from June 2019, and quite a lot of what May and Hammond did, albeit in very different directions, in that May thought the big thing was tuition fees, Hammond thought the big thing was, you know, visible symbols of austerity like potholes and homelessness. Everything the Conservative Party has done up until now has been based around the idea that broadly most of the cuts have reached their political end. You just can't do any more. And they had to spend more in order to see off Jeremy Corbyn. Now, the Rishi Sunak argument is interesting because actually what he is arguing explicitly to MPs and what he did yesterday is basically go, no, I think the issue was Philip Hammond didn't have a big enough role in the 2017 election. And if we don't have a clear economic dividing line, then what happened is the 2017 election result. Either of those, and obviously there's lots of middle ground that I've artificially kind of destroyed there in order to be somewhat succinct. Either of those is plausible. And I kind of think that is the thing we're going to find out over the next 4 years.
you've been enjoying our podcast and want to find out more about what we think, and some of our colleagues too, then why not subscribe to The New Statesman? You can get 12 weeks for £12. Go to newstatesman.com/subscribe12.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And now it's time for a section we like to call
You Ask Us.
So we've had lots of questions about the Alex Salmond investigation inquiry. The question we're going to kick off with would just be simply, has Nicola Sturgeon done enough to keep her job in her appearances at the inquiry into her government's handling of harassment complaints against her predecessor, Alex Salmond? What do you think, Anoush? Do you think she's sort of done enough to save her position for now?
I think if you go off her performance at the Holyrood inquiry yesterday, where she was questioned for 8 hours, I think you would think that her position is probably safe because she put in a really quite unflustered and strong performance. I mean, a lot of the people who were commenting on the inquiry, rather than being distracted by the budget, were noting how, you know, it was just a sign of how impressive a politician that she is, that she can undergo that level of questioning for so long and come out relatively unscathed. Our own Scotland editor, Chris Deering, wrote that she handled it with suppleness and surgical precision, which, you know, we perhaps shouldn't be very surprised by, particularly recently we've seen the way that she's responded to the crisis in Scotland and that it has generally been well received by people who are polled in Scotland so far. So I think her performance was good. I think the strongest thing that she did, which I thought was probably the most impressive angle, was that she did try and resurrect that whole atmosphere and the feeling and the passion and the hurt that was brought up around the Me Too era. So sort of that 2017, 2018 time when everyone really started searching within themselves and, you know, a lot of people's behaviour was exposed in high profile organisations. And she really tried to bring that feeling back into people's memories. So she spoke about not wanting to follow the age old pattern of allowing a powerful man to use his status and connections to get what he wants. She also kind of just tried to remind us of that climate throughout giving her evidence. She said it was a reflection of the invidious, almost impossible position a lot of people found themselves in during that time, talking about how decades-long relationships had been ripped apart and, you know, how friends and colleagues all had different things to say. And it was very difficult to try and reconcile, you know, what someone was being accused of with the people who were making the allegations, particularly in a party where, you know, her and Salmond were longtime allies. So she kind of really humanized the kind of dilemma and the situation that she was in at the time, which I thought was quite clever because I think almost everyone can relate to friendships being torn apart by Me Too revelations and everyone can remember the kind of fervour of that time. So I thought that was quite interesting. But there is another inquiry specifically into whether she breached the ministerial code. And that's also going to report before the Holyrood election. So I think that's something that we need to keep an eye on as well. I don't think she's got off scot-free, sorry for the pun, so far.
Well, it's interesting. So I had this slightly surreal thing of effectively watching it on a slight time delay.
Yeah.
In that I would watch it, I would cover, yeah, I watched, I started watching it, the budget happened, I went back to watching it during the various breaks. I think I made up the time, so I ended up finishing only about an hour after it actually finished. Now, it seems to me, right, there are, oh, it's that favourite time, Stephen commits to a numbered list. There are three scenarios under which Nicola Sturgeon could have to resign, right?
So obviously this inquiry is looking into the Scottish government's handling of these allegations against Alex Salmond, right? Scenario one, and this is broadly the argument being advanced by Alex Salmond and by some of his allies, which is that there was a conspiracy between members of the SNP leadership and the Scottish government to diminish his reputation to potential upper end of fitting him up and him going to prison. Right. That's obviously a scenario, which if that were found to be the case, Nicola Sturgeon would have to resign. Scenario two is that these allegations, yeah, regardless of their truth, were looked into in such an appallingly handled way that it was impossible for the women to get justice. And this was directly due to bad decisions made by Nicola Sturgeon herself. Right. And then, of course, it's hard to see how she wouldn't have to resign. Argument three would be that the SNP had long known that there were serious and credible allegations about Alex Salmond floating around. And then in the wake of the Me Too movement, the party leadership and the Scottish government's leadership panicked when we've just got to be seen to be tough on this problem we know we have. And then everything then went wrong with the investigation into it flowed from that central mistake. And those are basically the three situations in which this inquiry could produce something which would cause Nicola Sturgeon to have to resign. And one of the things I think has been the story, not just of yesterday's session, but of basically everything that the Holyrood inquiry has done, is that the reason why I don't think this inquiry is going to bear any fruit in terms of the obvious aim of most of the opposition members of the committee is that if you asked most of them, which one of those scenarios do you think is it? Which one are you aiming for? They'd go, pass. Whereas Nicola Sturgeon, unless she is the best actor in the world, not just is she the best actor in the world, but she has been deliberately performing the role of someone who, for all her undoubted political strengths, is not someone I would say is good at the thing I'm about to describe, in order to carry off this... then unless your argument is that Nicola Sturgeon has been like being like a bit sort of like... I'm awkward but competent and firm, and I do this kind of odd sort of head bob when I'm feeling a bit pressed. Unless your argument she has been performing that routine since the 90s in order to one day be able to plausibly look like someone who, whether she is right or wrong, clearly, sincerely believes the allegations against Alex Salmond to have been true, right? So unless you think that we are watching a kind of Oscar-winning performance for the ages, that is clearly where she is. Whereas, with the exception of Jackie Bailey, I don't think any of the opposition MSPs really have an idea what it is they're hoping for, what they think they're trying to find. Now, obviously, when you have an inquiry, sometimes what you think you're trying to find is not, in fact, the case. But if your questions aren't trying to sincerely find something out, you're probably not going to find something out. This was an inquiry which, at one point you have, members of the committee barking at her when she forgets to say alleged. Now, obviously, they did need to get her to correct record because they are only allegations. But it's one of those things where if on the one hand you're barking at someone, then it's alleged. You can't then have a situation where later on in the day, another Scottish MSP, Murdo Fraser, then goes, are you going to apologise to the country for the fact that it turns out that he may have done these things? Because it's just like, well, it wasn't clear from Murdo Fraser's questions up until that point whether he thought that he had, right? And this is, I think that to me is the biggest reason why I just cannot envisage a situation where this inquiry causes her to have to go or any of the other inquiries. Because, okay, now you can sometimes, the other example of this is Yvette Cooper ending Amber Rudd's Home Office career, where Yvette Cooper quite clearly didn't really have an idea of what Amber Rudd had done wrong, other than not being on top of it, right? I don't think that Yvette Cooper knew that Amber Rudd was sufficiently not on top of it that when she was asked, do you have targets for a manifesto commitment? She was going to go, no, we don't. That is a level of grip that I think that I do think it's one of those things where everyone has kind of almost forgotten that while it was clearly a good question because it exposed a problem, the level of the quality of the question has been hyped up at the expense of people understanding just how bad it was that Amber Rudd fell foul of that question. But you could tell that broadly, all of Yvette Cooper's questions were based on this idea of, I don't think you're on top of this, I don't think you're competent, and I think if I keep asking competence questions, that will unravel. Whereas broadly, most of the questions Nicola Sturgeon is being asked in these inquiries can be boiled down to an MSP standing up and going, I don't like you and I don't like Scottish independence. And some of the questions are just people standing up and going, I don't like you, but I do like Scottish independence. Someone going, I do like you, I don't like you, I don't like trans, but I do like Scottish independence. But you know, like, none of those things, none of those are going to be questions that yield answers which cause her to have to stand down. And that to me is, I think, like, my central take home for all of this is that I think someone who doesn't follow politics closely, who watched like a clip of this on the six or the nine, or I was actually listening to it on music radio, but because of various cuts of BBC funding, they will just hear news from London and England, I think will have gone, okay, she might have messed up, but she clearly sincerely believes and there's a problem. These, and oh, these other people, they're practically salivating over this. They're enjoying it, which is just distasteful. With the exception that, there are a couple of exceptions, of whom Jackie Bailey has been the one who's quite rightly got most of the plaudits, because she's consistently been the person who's been trying to find answers. But yeah, I just think it means that she has no prospect of being done in by these inquiries, although the internal battle in the SNP is another question entirely. What do you think, Albert?
I agree with both of you that I think because of not just the way Nicola Sturgeon has framed it, but just like the way in which this is just framed, whether she does it consciously or not, the way in which we're looking at this through the lens of Me Too and the sort of the gender politics of this, and also that personal relationship between Nicola Sturgeon and Alex Salmond, I think it means that the burden for Nicola Sturgeon having personally messed up on this and that being a sackable offence is very, very high. Like, she is not tasked with proving that she never made a mistake in this. And she's sort of freely admitted to making those mistakes. But that's sort of all basically pardonable due to the context that you've both outlined. And so I think that it's sort of for that reason, I think that she's probably safe throughout. I think those two interwoven human things of the personal complicatedness of how she related to her predecessor, her former mentor, and like her friend going stretching back decades, how she was relating to him and communicating to him, and also the wider politics of it and the importance of looking into certain allegations. And as you say, you know, clearly the implicit belief on her part that these allegations were true. I think, yeah, for that reason, she is in a pretty safe position. And I also think that the thing that this inquiry and the way it's being talked about doesn't really, like, the thing that gets left out because it's just on the level of an inquiry and covering the inquiry is that I just think overall, even though loads of people have political problems with Nicola Sturgeon and the SNP doing really well in Scotland, I think even despite that, there is just not very much appetite, I think, anywhere to see the casualty of very serious allegations against this prominent male politician being the female First Minister of Scotland. I just think that loads of people, whether they are following this a little bit or not at all, would find it perverse that at the end of this process, the person who had to resign, whose career was damaged, was the woman looking into it. And there's clearly not much space in the discussion around this for people to say that, because it is on the technicalities of how this was handled by the government and so on. But I just think that when push comes to shove, that's where a lot of people are with this. And for that reason, Nicola Sturgeon has the wind at her back, I think. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Alva Ray, and my colleagues Stephen Bush and Anoush Shakelian. You can find me on Twitter at @pronouncedalva.
You can find me on Twitter at @Anoush_C.
You can find me on Twitter at @StephenKB.
We're produced by Nick Hilton, and our music is Devil with the Devil, licensed under Creative Commons. Thanks for listening. Please remember to rate and subscribe.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.